Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I speak with Molly Dalson, founder of Mesh Architecture, and a professor who beautifully weaves teaching and research into her professional practice. Her approach is deeply human-centered, rooted in community, connection, and impact. Her intertwined approach relates perfectly to the weaver bird. A weaver bird crafts intricate nests from found materials in their environment. This process reflects the resourcefulness and care of Molly's architectural practice. And like Molly's work, these creations aren't just shelters, they're woven expressions of connection, built to house future generations. In this episode, we talk about the impact of human-centric design on the architecture of our society. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and today I'm meeting with Molly, who is both a professor and an architecture firm owner for Mesh Architecture. Molly, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Molly, can you tell us a little bit about Mesh Architecture and your practice that pairs teaching with professional application?
Yeah. So Mesh Architecture started it about 2 years ago, which seems a little wild. Seems like it's been forever and simultaneously very quick. But it's basically a practice that connects my role as a teacher in both design studios and in research, my own interests in research as a continual mode of inquiry and practice, and then my desire to continue to do built work and get projects built. I think I started it mainly because, well, I had two kids and I needed kind of a different idea about time and productivity. And so I took a step back, and I'd say a step forward, in creating Mesh Architecture as a place where I could focus teaching, research, and built work together as kind of one holistic practice.
Which of those three came first for you?
That's a really good question. I feel they're so heavily intertwined. I'd probably say some form of research came first. I actually have a background in chemistry and scientific research. And so I think when I went to do my MArch, that sort of mode of questioning things and connecting things to a broader network, that was even further developed in architecture school, and sort of the various modes of methods of questioning you could do in architecture versus in science and the scientific method. So I guess I'd say research came first and is sort of the underlying current through this.
And so straight out of school, back when you graduated, did you continue teaching at the college, or did you practice exclusively for other architecture firms for a while?
Right out of school, I was teaching drawing. I think it's technically called like critical inquiry through drawing. So I started teaching that right out of grad school. That transitioned into teaching design studios. And then that transitioned into teaching or adding research as a teaching mode as well. I was doing the teaching while I was working full-time at firms. I started at a larger firm locally, doing big sort of education and civic projects, and then transitioned to a smaller scale firm, doing lots of smaller scale community-based projects, and continued teaching throughout all of that, except I think 1 year during the pandemic. I never taught online. So teaching has been there from the beginning too.
That's cool. So an interwoven practice this whole time. I really love that. It seems like it's been a good balance for you. And I'm curious how it shaped your creation of Mesh Architecture. Maybe we start with, what three words would you use to describe your firm's approach?
Yeah, the three words to describe the firm, I'd say, are human, number one, interconnected, which you've probably already heard me drop that term multiple times, and impact. And I can dig deep into any of those if you want, but...
Let's go into it. Yeah, I want to hear about it.
Okay.
Especially because as an architecture firm, yes, we design for humans, but sometimes we forget to mention the human element. And so the fact that that's one of your foundational words is really telling. So tell us more about that.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe at a big, broad scale, human to me is really about architecture as a cultural output, not only the building itself, the space itself as a cultural output, but also as a cultural driver, in that we're sort of, as humans, partners with our built environment. And as designers, it's our responsibility to be a good partner, not only as humans ourselves, but in designing these spaces for human interaction. And so, one, I'm just generally curious because humans are so different. And so when we're designing spaces, I'm very interested in understanding multiple human experiences, knowing that I have a personal lived experience, multiple other people have their own lived experiences. We all experience or embody space very differently. And so I've always been really challenged by and interested in this question that has no answer, but is more about how can we design for multiple uses, multiple perspectives, multiple ways of seeing our environments, that I guess boils down to, like, how can we diversify our spatial types so that we diversify the way we're engaging with each other, and then diversify our kind of cultural output. So human, yes, very important to me on that facet of design. And then also project teams. Like, we work with so many amazing people as architects. There's no solo genius, even though I'm a solo practitioner. So I think just remembering that architecture and the buildings that are getting built, the spaces that we're building, are such a human process. So that's where human comes from for me. There's like 10 more rabbit holes, but I promise I'll save it.
I love that. And so what kind of research do you dive into that helps you serve that interest?
Yes. Okay. Somewhat of a tricky one, because again, there's no answer. I'd say some of the things that, and maybe this is where research and teaching get kind of muddied too, because in some ways, some of the design studios I teach a form of research, in that multiple students are approaching a question that I'm proposing.
When one of your values is interconnected, I would expect nothing less than research to be integrated into a studio. I think that's a wonderful pairing. That environment's a wonderful place to dive in after those curiosities. So tell us more about some of the studios you've led.
Yeah. So some of the design studios I've led have been around housing, which is also a very human-based program, I'd say. That actually tends to not be viewed as a human program, sadly, sometimes.
I remember that, doing housing studios where you're actually trying to generalize what is a house.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a specific client to be able to find that specific human story that you're responding to with the architecture. And so you have to kind of generalize and wash it down. So how do you avoid that? And what kind of conversations can you have about providing housing?
Yeah, so that's a great topic. I think the things we talk a lot about in my design studios, one, like, we all know we're in a housing crisis. That's just, we've heard it. Okay. So then what do we do about it? And there's so many issues about multifamily housing, especially. I'll put that caveat out there. Multifamily housing being seen as simply efficient, or, you know, we need more density, which is of course true, but how do we do this in a way that's impactful for my third word? And so I think part of it is when we're talking about humans, and especially in multifamily housing, because it is not a single client. That client might be a developer, but the user, to use like the terminology general practices might use, is a human being having a home with other people in public space, more or less. And so we talk a lot about what that means to transition from, say, like a sidewalk and public space into a private dwelling, and all those social interactions and all those sort of thresholds that happen along the way of that journey. Even questions like, how would you describe to someone where your front door is? What is your front door? What's the boundary of your unit? And so we talk a lot about how different people perceive sort of domestic and maybe somewhat private-based space, and then some of the more collective space. And we really use representation. And that's sort of a realm of research I'm really interested in, is how do we actually represent different perspectives? Potentially AI can be really helpful in this way to give us quick glimpses. But we look at like, what type of scale figures are you using? Scale figures, again, is dehumanizing. They're meant to give you scale, versus like, who's there? What are they doing? What time is it? What year? All those sorts of things that get us a little bit more into the human base nature of housing.
I was noticing that in some of your visuals on your website. So that's really exciting to hear that that's a conscious effort in how you're representing those graphics. I think that gives a good baseline of what influenced you to start mesh architecture. As you're doing this as your own practice, what types of clients and projects are you serving or seeking out?
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges of being a sole practitioner is scale in general. So there's lots of pros to being a sole practitioner, but maybe I'd say one of the cons is some of those multifamily housing projects, at least at the moment, feel a little out of reach. However, I would say that I'm still working with developers in kind of a variety of capacities. Some is just more networking and talking about different projects here and there. So maybe not a client that I'm designing built work for yet, but also developers that I have previous connections to that are interested in building housing that is maybe not the typical 5-over-1 construction type we see. And it's not a single family house only, but there's something there that they're somewhat interested in that's unique. And they tend to be long-term owners, which is really important to me to be able to think about the impact of designs over multiple years instead of maybe a 5-year and then flip. So I'm still working with developers. Also, nonprofit organizations. I worked with Hennepin Theater Trust. They're so fantastic. Business owners. And then I do work with private single family home owners, but typically it's not, I'd say it's not like a high end single family home project. Like a current project is kind of 1950s Rambler that's, we're converting pragmatically into aging in place, but also has this big front porch to kind of connect back to the street in this suburban area where there's not a lot of kind of social community connection in this particular neighborhood. So things like that I'll tackle as well. Housing and social space, human connection, you kind of get the gist.
I do. And sometimes that idea of mixing consulting along with networking and private residential versus multifamily, like, we try to put those all in boxes as types of architecture, but what I'm hearing from you is a deeper connection than just project type. There's a conversation you want to have with people, and there's a conversation you're good at having with people about those thresholds and about living in valuable space. And I love that longevity piece as well, because sometimes that's where our sense of home comes from, is over time. And we don't get to just instantly build that in place. That's something that the humans who live in our buildings grow and thrive within if we've done our design the way we intend to.
Yeah, one of the examples I talk to my students about are some of the housing complexes that there's like laundry hanging out, there's plants on the balcony, and designers that integrate that into the facade versus hoping that nobody puts any tchotchkes out. It's like, how do we, you know, people live. People are living their reality, and let's embrace that and design for that. So I love that you kind of brought that up there.
And letting go of control is hard.
It is.
Especially when it's in our computer and it's in our rendering programs. We can control everything, every blade of grass. And that's just not the reality. And especially as talking with students, working with students, and actually probably talking with homeowners about what to expect with the end result. Like, you're going to work with them as much as possible to get everything in place, but there's going to be things that come up that were not anticipated along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, I had mentioned impact earlier. That's a huge piece of it, of coming back to projects, even if it's like driving by and taking photos 3 years later. It did the Dudley Riggs Theater lobby, and going to shows and people watching. It's just so great to see how different people inhabit the spaces and what the impact really is. Because my intention, and I talk with students a ton about this too, of intent versus impact, you know, intention may be well-meaning, but the impact could be very different. And so it's super important to go back to projects, talk with people, continue having conversations, be open about quote unquote mistakes you've made. I mean, I wouldn't call it a mistake, I guess, because you learn something, but continuing to learn and work with those larger groups of people is super important. So longevity, impact, interconnectedness. Yeah, really important to me.
That's wonderful. And so how are you making connections with these contractors who are interested in designing multifamily differently, or even homeowners or business owners who care about these topics that you're putting so much effort into? Not mistakes, but learning. You've learned a lot of lessons in this category. So how are you meeting people who are interested in that mission?
Yeah, honestly, it's something I'm still working through, being on my own now, but it generally has been a variety of networking types of events, which I can go into, but also word of mouth. So I've relied a lot on whether it's students I've had or other professors or colleagues that maybe they're working for a large firm that's not going to take that project, but they're like, hey, I think this is up your alley. So I've been really lucky so far for it to basically all be word of mouth. But I also think that comes from sort of putting myself in the right rooms, I guess. And that piece comes from just a genuine interest. Like, one of the best parts about going off on my own is having a little more flexibility. You know, in a traditional office, those networking hours are non-billable. Right. And so when I'm working through my financial models, it's different than a traditional practice. And so I can spend more time at conferences. Or I was in the Real Estate Diversity Initiative through the Urban Land Institute. I'd say that was 4 or 5 years ago now.
Was that a Minnesota initiative?
It is a Minnesota program, so it's locally.
Okay.
And we met in person. There are all sorts of up-and-coming developers, financial and like loan officers, basically, architects. That was probably the bulk of the group. But we had a project that we worked out, so we had to do a pro forma. We had to make a site design. And we had to showcase kind of the financial implications too. And so those are the sorts of places that, like, I'm really interested in learning about development and real estate. And then that makes me interested in financial models, affordable housing opportunities and restrictions, I'd say, for financing. And so I tend to kind of move not just within the architecture realm, but kind of these other disciplines that are related, and trying to learn kind of their system and understand the whole of it, so that we can all kind of uncover what barriers there are to getting good projects built, because everyone wants that. and then work towards that. And so I'd say the networking is from the research in some way and from just wanting to create the biggest impact, find kind of the systems to work within. And so hopefully as this continues going, maybe there'll be more built work that comes out of that. But right now it's a lot of listening and learning still.
Well, these can be long lead time projects. I'm curious what it's like to infiltrate different networks. And is that done by invite, or do you invite yourself as an architect and say, hey, this is, proformas are not necessarily taught in grad school, but I understand what they are and I want to learn more and I'm here to learn and talk. How do you enter the room like that?
That's a good question. The Real Estate Diversity Initiative has some architects that are also helping. So it's kind of a broad team. So that one felt more, even though I was one of maybe two or three architects out of 30 something folks, it still felt like there was already a place set out. There was space set aside for architects to be there. Some of the others are honestly from clients that I worked with previously, developers. So there's Women in Real Estate Development. It's called Wired Up. And so they kind of got me into that, and they do a bunch of fun events, lunch and learns. And it's really informal, but it's a great way to just see what other people are doing. And so I don't know if I have a great answer for you, but I think it has stemmed more from maybe having personal relationships. Again, just being genuinely interested. And then someone's like, oh, hey, there's this other opportunity, than saying, hey, I'm going to come to this event and push my way in.
Bang down the door.
Yeah.
No, that definitely breaks the threshold. No, that's great. I've done something similar in taking on some studios at Dunwoody, where I volunteer with Minnesota Design Team because I'm passionate about serving small communities. And after going on visits to certain communities, I then was teaching studios, and it was a site and city studio. So I'm like, hey, I've been to this small town. Let's take these students to this small town. And leveraging those same contacts, leveraging some of the information and research that was done as part of a Minnesota Design Team visit, so that it kicks these students off on these conversations and then giving them a design problem to pursue. But starting them off with like a bit more of a grounding in the community, because I knew a little bit more about the community. But as a professional, it's a way for me to stay connected with people from this volunteer effort. It's also a way to continue serving that community, because they're usually pretty excited to see students, a bunch of architecture students, come in and design something, a shelter or something for their town, and seeing that energy and effort put into the place that they love and they live. And so that's one way I've kind of tried to pair, as a solo practitioner, practice and teaching and volunteering towards that same effort. Have you found, do you have a similar example of how you've woven those pieces together?
Well, I'd say first, yes, in some ways. So previously I worked at a firm that was in the Whittier neighborhood. And actually, again, personal relationships, being out in the city is important. I met someone at the gym, and she was the Whittier Neighborhood Alliance executive director. Their office was right next door. They were putting out an RFP for a really interesting joint ownership project, where like the neighborhood organization, the nonprofit, would actually buy the land and then partner with an organization to build and sort of rent out the building, but super interesting ownership model and taking a stake in the neighborhood truly. So I took that RFP and sort of modeled a studio for 2 years, somewhat around that. There were some limitations that I honestly wanted to take out of the RFP, because part of school is like the what if. You want enough constraints where you can ideally translate from academic to practice, right? We don't want this big, like, theory only, and then you get into practice and you're like, what happened? However, if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we're not going to come up with unique and novel solutions to some of the issues we're facing. So we kind of modified that RFP a little bit and then worked with her and someone from the city of Minneapolis to look at the results and what the students had come up with. So that was one way to kind of make that connection. I think those can be hard to sustain longer term because it's taxing. It's a lot of time and effort for the community folks involved, and you want to make sure you're not exploiting that community. But it is a great way to get grounded, I think, as you mentioned earlier. And then I'd say a second way that is not related to teaching, but I just became co-chair of the Housing Advocacy Committee. So next couple of years, we'll be working with that amazing group of people. And the Search for Shelter is one of those projects that works with local nonprofits and does a sort of speculative project for them. And so that's another great way to just continue kind of developing knowledge across multiple audiences and populations of people. So I'm really looking forward to being more involved in that the next couple of years.
I've done Search for Shelter maybe 4 or 5 times, and I just loved it. It was so good to make space for it as a student. If any of your students hear this, it is, yes, taxing, but it is worth the effort because it is so wonderful to connect with real people and real problems and just be grounded in that for a moment. Because yes, it's so fun to do the what ifs, but it's also good to get that feedback earlier on from humans.
And again, that multiple perspectives, like, it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong or right. It's just the more input you get, the more you can understand what you're doing and why and the effect it has on others. So I think balancing those things is really important, and setting good parameters for design studios is challenging because you want students to, there's sort of a pedagogical realm you need to cover, skill building, you need to cover theoretical inquiry, all these things, technical development, but then you really want them, they are so smart and they are so creative, and it is just, you want them to be able to take that step too.
Do you think keeping a foot in academia is keeping your practice fresh and keeping a little bit of that student mindset and that inquiry in your practice so that it doesn't feel like it gets too rigid or traditional?
Yes, absolutely. I think that was part of the reason of starting my own practice as well. Again, just those timescales of a built project, of course, has certain time constraints and deadlines and deliverables because there are certain economic and financial modes at play. And that is extremely important to do that and do it well. And I think have time for probing those bigger, muddier, creative questions, the what ifs. What if I designed this? Should we research that project and figure out what the barriers are to making that project happen? So a student might come up with something that's like, man, everyone wants to live there. That is such a great space. Like, you've nailed this connection between unit and public space, whatever it might be. And then sort of part of my practice is then, okay, so if that were a project, and with my practice experience and project management experience, what are the barriers that are, why isn't that happening? Why can't we build that? Is it labor, construction expertise? Is it financial implications? What are those things? And then go to talk to those people and figure out, like, would it be worth it? So it's kind of whittling those things down. And that takes a lot longer to figure out than maybe a traditional cycle of a built project, which is also long and a lot of work. You know, we're in a field that is, like I said earlier, a cultural endeavor, but its time scale is very different than, say, music or painting, I guess.
Yes, very fascinating. And boy, that's a rabbit hole we could go down to as to the feedback loop. I'd really love to, but I would actually like to give you your bird if you're ready for it.
I'm ready.
All right. So, Molly, I think your bird, and this may be too spot on, but I think you're a weaver bird.
Mm.
And a weaver bird, if we don't have them really in North America, they can adapt here, but they're primarily in Africa and Asia, and they build these great big nests. And part of that that relates to your practice is that they just grab the materials that are around them. And so they're resourceful. And a young male weaver bird who's starting to build his nest for the first time is also like practicing. It's trial and error. It's responding to what he's got. And he's got to learn how it's going to be and how it's going to be shaped based on those materials that he has. But it's also, they're very communal. And that reminds me of your interaction with students, that even though you're a sole practitioner, you do have this wealth of community that you've built, that you're training these students in these practices. And that's a way that you're learning and you're building for a long term, because sometimes these nests last for generations. And so there's a beautiful image there, and calling your firm mesh architecture plays off of that woven quality, and also saying you're interconnected. It all just kind of like pieces together. And what I love hearing about is that you've also pieced a lot of your personal strengths, hopes, and dreams together with the life that you've structured around yourself. And I'd love to hear how you're framing that, because I'm encountering a similar, baby number four is on the way for me. I've got a solo practice. I'm taking a little break from teaching right now, but trying to imagine what this life is like of making long-term impact in the built environment and meaningful impact to humans. And how do you come up with what you put your time towards?
Yeah, I think that I've tried to think about this in three or four different time chunks. There's the what's going to happen in a year. What am I focusing on? What happens in 5, 10? I think for me, at least right now, and the age that my kids are at, and the, like, say, non-architecture local communities that I want to be involved in and am involved in, that I'm making space for those things to happen, which is surprising for me, because growing up, my mother always told me patience is a virtue, because I had none. And I was more of the knock the door down type person. So I have been giving myself a lot of space around those things. And the idea of cycles has been, I'd say, a bigger part of my practice now, in that I think I have shot more heavily around teaching and research and pulling things together and gathering. And I feel like I'm sort of at the precipice of, okay, now there's going to be an output of things that flow from this. And that in 5 years, this practice could look totally different, but that it flows organically, that it's not forced. And I think teaching also gives me some financial stability to be able to manipulate that relationship of what's the revenue stream of practice and where does that come from. And I think other potentials are, depending on where sort of the research grant realm goes, there's lots of research I've done into other practices where they're partnering with nonprofits to do research grants. And so I think that, to me, that's sort of the future trajectory. And longer term, I am super interested in alternative business models. So I think you were spot on that I am a sole practitioner, but that network and that sort of collective is much bigger than, and I'm hopeful that I can figure out a way to eventually modify my practice model to include others, whether it's a collective, cooperative. There's some really interesting people doing great stuff in that regard for another day. But that's sort of where I'm looking longer term.
I love that you're keeping that in flex, because sometimes when an architect takes on a business plan, it seems like such a daunting effort. We're like, I'm just going to do it once and then it's going to be done forever. Yeah. I'm never going to have to look at this again. But having it, accepting it as a living, breathing document that is just kind of like, I don't know, the plans of your building. It's the plans of your business. And, you know, there might be an addition later on or a revision to the plan later on, and letting that be and not assuming you're going to get it perfect the first time. There's going to be a good enough and there's going to be something that's right for right now. But letting that adapt. And sometimes that's hard when we're in the business of building something that we want to stand for 500 years or at least 50. And that's not always the case in our modern culture, but it's a goal to have something last longer. And so a business plan is more like one of those temporary shelters, potentially adapting over time.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I do them almost every year because otherwise it can be totally kind of lost in this cloudy web of something that I'm doing. And I'm like, I kind of know what I'm doing, but I don't know. And so it's really helpful to attempt to write a strict business plan from that and then say, hey, these are the things I'm going to take out of this stricter business plan. And these are the things that don't work for me, like traditional marketing, not for me.
Yeah. And that's fascinating that you revisit it each year as part of that cycle. And maybe it's not a year for each person, but that's what's kind of fitting in with possibly the semester.
Yeah.
Or two semesters that you're dealing with school, and it kind of fits into that rhythm. That's wonderful. What sort of, and gosh, you did a plug against traditional marketing. So how would you define the traditional marketing that, like, I'm never going to do that?
Yes. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't be so antagonistic.
It's fine. Who is out there beating the drum of traditional marketing right now?
I don't know. And it's something too that is very confusing in architecture in general, because we're a service industry, but yet there's a quote unquote product at the end. So lots of architecture websites are these portfolios of final built work with these beautiful architectural photography images. People are staged in the appropriate places. You know, everything is to a T. And I guess I'd say that that's something I struggle with. And you probably see on my own website some of these struggles, because I don't know, I'm almost of the like kind of photojournalism mindset. Like, what are people doing that day? It goes back to the impact and human thing. And so I guess if sort of the portfolio of work website is maybe a traditional marketing tool, that's one that I struggle with, where I do want to show a portfolio of work, and that's very important to show the outcome of different projects. But I'd say a lot of it is way more process oriented of like, how do we meet with the right people? How do we bring people together to get the most impactful, do more with less project in the end? And so it may not look quote unquote high design, whatever that means to another rabbit hole, but the sort of process and the outcome are the important piece. And so that's where the traditional marketing, I guess, doesn't work for the firm that I've built currently.
Well, and one of your pieces on your website is modifying a church into multiple housing pieces. And so someone seeing that project may say, hey, I have a church. I want multiple houses. This person's the right fit for me. But what you're trying to communicate is a process that any existing building that you may not assume fits the traditional residential model can be thought of as a communal living space. And that is the challenge right now in today's environment of communicating your value, communicating what you do to people as a service. And so I'm really curious how that's going to continue to evolve through, whether it's storytelling or video or presentations, or if it's just in having conversations with people about projects. And when you're able to have that one-on-one conversation, you're able to cater it to fit so that they understand that, yes, you're talking about a church and housing, but they have a building that's maybe an abandoned Walmart or a theater or something. And talking with them, well, that is a challenge that you have that building, but here is a way that you can rethink those spaces. And here's really the value of the housing and the value of working with me to help you rethink the infrastructure to be adapted to this purpose.
Right. I think that's exactly it. And I always bring up this oxymoron, but you know, I'm really building broad expertise. I told you it's an oxymoron, but in that I think my strengths are really taking these complex things and figuring out the most overlaps, again, do more with less. And that's not just materials. It's like, what systems are playing here? How can you do more with those systems? And I think, you know, the church to housing project is a great example of that. It's unsubsidized housing that has generally affordable, some affordable units, some market rate, but it's not tax incentivized. And like, that's a huge driver of this, that these units are so interesting because some of them have like the chapel ceiling and stuff and existing light fixtures, but they're not like, again, quote unquote, like high design final thing. So I think they do a lot, but photos don't do that justice.
It's finding that story to tell. That's great. Well, Molly, is there any advice that you like to give someone who's thinking of embarking on this, like they have seemingly dissimilar interests, and how do you piece that together? How do you interweave that together into a holistic practice?
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not great advice, but part of the advice is just keep doing what genuinely interests you. And I'd say that every single kind of experience that I've had from architecture school till now, I'm always finding the thing that I'm learning. So some of it is professional practice related, some of it is project related, research, whatever it might be. And it's taken me a while, but uncovering the threads of interconnection, if you can keep digging for those and stay at it, it's like the hard work is trying to synthesize all that together. But if you're able to keep doing that while enjoying and learning new things with every project, even if it's like a project type you don't love, there's always something to learn. I think that builds sort of the confidence and the expertise to when you decide you want to do something else, you're sort of ready to go do that. Yeah. And just being engaged in multiple different networks. People are so different, and the way that developers talk about issues is very different than the way architects might talk about it, is different than a cultural anthropologist. And so yet those things are interconnected in my mind.
And that almost comes down to just good research practices of like finding multiple sources for the research that you're doing. You're researching this in every aspect, both in how you're networking and who you're networking with. And that really shows in how you're piecing together this complex puzzle, and it's continuing to grow. It's really cool. Great. Thank you so much, Molly. It was a joy talking with you, and this has been a fun conversation. I hope you've enjoyed this.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me, Katie.
Mesh architecture is the perfect description for Molly Dason's practice. She seamlessly works as an architect, educator, and community builder. Much like the nests woven by the weaver bird, these birds are remarkable for their ability to take what's available, the grass, twigs, and leaves in their immediate surroundings, and turn it into something both functional and beautiful. And in that, we can find our first takeaway. For solopreneur architects, we need to be resourceful with what's in front of us. Molly described doing more with less and how architecture at its best responds to context, whether that's the site, the client, or the community. She reminds us that creativity often thrives under constraints. When designers need to work within specific parameters, they dive deeper into unique solutions, just as the weaver bird doesn't wait for the perfect branch. We as designers also start building with what we have, trusting that the process itself will teach us what's next. Because ultimately, we are never alone in a construction project. whether it is the plans examiner, engineering consultant, client, or someone in aisle 17 of the hardware store, we are never left alone in our projects. Which leads us to our second takeaway. We need to make connections and lean upon the community we build around us. While the Weaverbird is known for its individual artistry, its nests are often built alongside others, forming entire colonies woven together by proximity, showing that they have a shared purpose of security within a community. Molly's firm, Mesh Architecture, embodies that same spirit. Though she practices as a solo architect, her work is far from solitary. Through teaching, she cultivates relationships with students, nurturing the next generation of designers while keeping her own practice vibrant and evolving. In her community-focused projects, she invites comments, which broadens the connections around her projects and allows more people to invest in the outcomes. For those of us running solo practices, this is an important reminder. Community doesn't have to mean a large professional team. It can be found in mentorship, teaching, or even small collaborations that challenge and inspire us. Our networks, our mesh, become the structure that sustains us. The stronger our connections, the more impact we can make with long-lasting solutions for our clients. And that is our final takeaway, building legacy. Weaverbirds don't just build temporary shelters. Their nests are woven to endure, sometimes lasting for generations. Molly's focus on human-centered design reflects that same commitment to create spaces that outlast trends so that the architecture can meaningfully shape the lives of those who inhabit them. She invites us to think about intent versus impact, not just what we aim to design, but how our work resonates beyond the project deadlines. For solopreneurs, this is a powerful reflection. Every choice we make, every detail we design contributes to a larger story about how architecture serves people. Consider how the different threads of your life, different interests, various connections could be crossed or woven into stronger meaning. As a solopreneur, we can borrow from things around us, making connections that others often overlook. Those are the gaps in our communities that we can patch. We solo architects can make a difference in those communities that we live, work, and play in. Because, like a weaver bird, when we build with intention and care, our work doesn't just shelter, it becomes part of a living, interconnected design that can inspire and endure for generations to come. Season 2 of the Flying Solo Podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live, that's flyingsolo.live, for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.